Welcome to the Sagebrush Variety Show, sagebrushvariety.org, political commentary and satire. On this week's show, we've got part four of Corporate Prime, our serial radio drama about life in post-peak oil Western United States, written by Kevin Bayhouse. We've got a bunch of short little features on the show today, but also we've got the Sagebrush Variety Show Farm Report on growing your own tomatoes. And on Homeland Security, Level Red, an episode entitled Kittens and Puppies and Terrorists, Oh My, taking a look at how the FBI targets animal rescuers as potential domestic terrorists. But first, the Backyard Chicken Broadcast with Bucky Bacaw on Breeds of Chickens. I'm producer Gwen Sanchirico. Enjoy the show.
Welcome to the Backyard Chicken Broadcast. One of the questions people ask when they are on the verge of inviting chickens to live in their backyard is, what breed of chicken should I get? I take the same view towards chicken breed preferences that I do towards people who are excessively concerned with cat or dog breeds. There are some very striking physical qualities that are unique to certain breeds, but in terms of temperament, I believe the variation is more about the individual bird than it is about their breed. Chicken lovers love to make generalizations about breeds and personalities, but you also will have a hard time finding two chickeny folk who have the same opinion, and they all love to talk about the many exceptions they encounter. Well, I had this chicken who was an ex-breed, but he did this or that, and isn't that surprising? Egg-laying habits, or broodiness, which means how often they decide to try to hatch an egg, can be determined by breed, and definitely play into how affectionate or handleable a bird is. But even that is subject to a large degree of individual variation, so breed really doesn't make that big of a difference. On the other hand, I will admit that chickens are beautiful creatures, and it's not hard to understand why a person may decide they really want to be able to look out their window and see a Polish or other crested breed strutting around their yard with their distinctive umbrella of feathers, in the case of a cock, or a hen with the powder puff head. And that's just one example. However, I still really believe that the most important thing is to get the chicken you plan to raise from a reputable source, one that you know treats their animals well. I know from experience that sometimes it can seem easier to get your first chicks from a pet store or large commercial breeder, but in most cases, it's not that much more trouble, but much more satisfying to find and work with a small-scale or hobby breeder. A small-scale breeder might specialize in a particular breed, or they might raise hybrids. Either way, they're likely to tell you that their chickens have the best genetics in the region. The important thing isn't so much the breed as it is that you'll be supporting small-scale farming and a humane and respectful approach to raising chickens. However, one breed characteristic that can be very important when it comes to backyard chickens is size. If you're like me and you have a relatively small yard, say 1,000 or 1,500 square feet, you may want to consider a smaller breed. Most breeds come in two versions, full-size and bantam, or banty, which has all the same physical characteristics, but is 1/5 to 1/4 the size. Many full-size varieties may weigh as much as 8.5-pound hen or 11-pound cock, where the banty version would be 1.5 or 2-pound hen and a rooster no more than 3 pounds. There are also a few breeds known as true bantams, and those are small chickens that have no large-size counterpart. Examples are Burmese, Rosecomb, Seabrat, or the old Dutch bantam, which is said to have been developed by peasants to provide small eggs in a time when the law stated that all or some large eggs were to go to the lord of the manor. It's also worth noting that at that time in history, chickens laid relatively few eggs per year as compared to contemporary birds. However, contemporary Dutch tend to lay more eggs than other banties, so it's possible that they were always ahead of the curve. The most obvious advantage of keeping banties, as opposed to full-size breeds, in a small backyard is they will have proportionately more space. it will be easier for you to house and handle them, and they also are less likely to entirely destroy your garden if they manage to get in unsupervised at a time when your seedlings are vulnerable. A disadvantage is that banties are less intimidating to any stray cats that might wander onto your property. Almost no cat will mess with a full-sized chicken, but the balance of power between banties and cats is a little too even for my tastes. Still, banties do tend to be better flyers and have a better chance of fleeing an attack. And of course, some might consider it a disadvantage that banties will lay smaller eggs. Personally, I find a couple of small backyard eggs more than adequate for a good breakfast. One of the birds living in my backyard goes by the name of Quincy and is of a breed I mentioned earlier, the Seabrat. That breed was developed by Sir John Seabrat early in the 1800s. It's the only breed of chicken named for an individual. Surprisingly, Quincy lays eggs that are very nearly the same size as the eggs laid by the two hens that are 35 to 50% larger than her. Sometimes I do wonder if the day will come when some government entity will start demanding a portion of the eggs from my backyard, so I kind of think of it as insurance that I've got small egg layers. If you have comments or questions or suggestions for other shows, please email me at sagebrush@radioboise.org. If you record the message in your own voice and send it to me in MP3 format, I just might play it on my next show. Bucky Bacaw, signing off. I had a good time. Bucky Bacaw's Backyard Chicken Broadcast was produced by the Sagebrush Variety Show with support from Boise Community Radio and the Green Institute.
Four months ago, I was living a whole different life. I was a security officer for the Corby City in the eastern part of Cascadia in the now defunct United States. It used to be the world's superpower until the oil wars that ensued a few decades ago. The wars were brought on by the decline of oil availability. That spurred all the world's military powers to hoard as much remaining oil and gas reserves as possible. Civil war reduced all of these countries to fractured has-beens. Within each nation-state, people warred with themselves over the table scraps of the natural resources needed to continue their decadent lifestyles. Life turned very dark after the oil wars left charred remains of what was once a functional society, smoking in the ruins of capitalist enterprise. I've been through a lot the last few years, but I probably shouldn't complain. I'm not sure there's any such thing as the easy life anyway, and lately I've been thinking we're better off without it. My name is David Ortega. And this is my story. Infiltrating this collection of farming and salvaging towns has gone off without a hitch. Really makes me wonder why corporate prime has put such a high price on what so far has basically been a vacation. Not that I know what a vacation is, other than a few extra days to watch TV and play poker. What in the world could have happened to Leonard Habib? According to Bearclaw, the wheels fell off the cart. That means even less to me now than it did when he recruited me for this assignment. I already put together a map of all the radio stations that serve as communication hubs and all the energy sites. The toughest thing about that was finding excuses to get away from Monica. Monica. Probably just that this job doesn't present enough of a challenge, but now that I blew her off, I kinda miss her company. Weird way for a committed loner like me to be thinking. But what's even weirder is that I felt strangely guilty for turning down the opportunity to help sort through garbage. In corporate prime, you do whatever you can to avoid work, especially that kind of job. But these people actually volunteer for these jobs with a smile, and still manage to have enough time to explore whatever the heck is out in the wilderness. I don't think there's any other information I need to learn, so I suppose attending this poker game tonight is unnecessary. Bearclaw said to get involved as little as possible, but I'm ahead of schedule, and what harm could it do? Truth is, I'm looking forward to it.
Hey, David, glad you can make it. Come on in. We don't get around to playing poker much anymore. A new player is just the motivation we need. Ready to meet your challengers? Everyone, this is David. This is Ken Dorn. He's a doctor, so if you have any aches and pains and you don't feel like waiting around at the clinic, you can ask him about it tonight. He loves that.
Good to meet you, David.
Same here, Doc.
Please, Ken. It fits better with my egalitarian ideas.
Oh, Ken, you know you thrive on the extra respect you get. And this is Pat Vitelli. She's an actor, playwright, and musician.
I'm a machinist who isn't afraid to get up on stage and make a fool of myself on community days.
Right. Funny how no one ever says, "Remember that wheat thrasher Pat Salvage last year?" But everyone is still singing the songs you wrote for last year's play.
I've never seen a play.
You poor thing! Stick around, we've got one opening in a couple of weeks.
And you already know me, Monica Claiborne, card game arranger.
So what are the stakes?
Same as anywhere. Currency. But we frown on excessive risk behavior.
Yeah, Monica should know. She had to work 2 40-hour weeks in a row last year to recover from an ill-advised bluff.
Yeah, that was tough. But I don't regret it. Every once in a while, you have to be a little reckless. Within reason. David, you're the guest, so you deal first. Here you go.
David, Monica tells us that you're from Wyoming and that you've been living in the Corpy Town in Narco City.
That's right.
I imagine that's a hellhole.
Pretty much, yeah.
How did you get out, if I may ask?
I just slipped out one night.
I see. I take it security is pretty lax.
Actually, it's fairly serious. Management wants to make sure drifters don't sneak in to steal stuff.
I heard you have to escape.
Nah, it's just when you get hired you have to agree to give 8 weeks notice before leaving. And there's all kinds of exit interviews and red tape. I didn't want to deal with all that, and I had insider knowledge on how to take the express exit.
What did you do there in the Corpy Town?
Oh, I built and maintained fences on the perimeter.
So in a way, you worked the security division?
I guess you could say that, yeah. Okay, everyone, what's your bet and how many cards? Monica?
I'll bet 10 and take 2 cards.
Here you go, 2 cards. Pat?
I'll bet 30 and take 1.
Well now, you're off in the hunt, aren't you? I'll bet 10 and take 3 cards. Can't wait to see what the dealer does.
I'll bet 30 also and take 1.
Monica, did you work in the engine warehouse today?
Yeah.
What did you have to sort?
We sorted a truckload of scavenged engines from old lawnmowers. What a waste of time those things must have been back in the day. Can you imagine actually creating a carpet of dumb grass just so you could cut it every week? What a joke!
What did you do with the rest of the mowers?
Break them down for whatever use we could come up with. The shop gets pretty creative with all the gadgets we've been finding.
Do you recycle anything or just reuse everything?
Our goal is to reuse as much as possible. Recycling uses lots of energy, so there has to be a strong justification for recycling materials.
Ken, where'd you learn medicine?
I was born in Nassau, in the Bahamas. My parents were both doctors. When peak oil hit, things got rough there, so we went to Cuba. I grew up there and stayed on for medical school, since their programs were the best in the world. I came to the United States with the Cuban relief effort to help with several crises areas along the southern coast. I chose to stay on and eventually found my way here, where I settled to continue offering my services. I also teach medicine to small classes when I have the time.
Speaking of lessons, when you guys are ready to learn how to get beaten at poker, I'm ready to raise the ante and clean you all out.
What did I say about gloating? I'll raise 20. No more cards.
Well, well. Back to you, Pat?
I'll see all this bravado and raise another 20. I'll stay with these cards, of course.
Too rich for my blood. I'll fold.
I'll see that and raise 20 more. These cards will do.
Okay, I'll call. What have you got?
Sorry, everyone. A full house.
No, I'm sorry, everyone. Straight flush.
Aw, man.
Over. We copy, Nomad. Ghost. Over. Copy, Nomad. Castle is really convinced they've got heavy weapons. Over.
I can't confirm what I can't find, Big Brother. Over.
Understood, Nomad. Please, make an effort to locate and report on heavy weapons ASAP. Over.
Sounds like Barraclaw is eager to find our major weapons.
Good luck with that. Most of our heavy stuff is scattered in so many different places, even we have trouble keeping track.
Learned that idea from the Swedes.
And the Vietnamese.
Yeah.
No hints on what their strike plan is?
No. And team leader is not currently reporting. Over. And Artig is not volunteering anything. I don't think even he knows, but that's just a hunch.
We're running out of time. Ortega's gonna have to get those maps to them soon.
I'm not convinced of that.
What do you mean?
Ever since we've been tracking the strike team with our radio direction finders, their signal hasn't left the dam. They're just lying to Ortega about where they are. You'd think they would be in Boise to pick up the maps if they were intent on using them, wouldn't you?
I see what you're saying. Have we fixed their exact location yet?
Not exactly. They've been smart enough to move around before each transmission to throw us off. And they're not going far, basically up and down the dam. We're getting a better idea each time they send a transmission, though.
So when do we go ahead and recruit Ortega? He should have seen enough by now to sway him, and we may need him to find the assault team and learn their plan.
I think he realizes we're not a ragtag bunch of raving anarchists. But he's not someone to flip just like that.
Should we introduce him to Lenny?
Yeah, I think it's time. And Lenny said he's willing to meet with him if we need him to.
That's good.
Well, keep monitoring their radio transmissions. Danny will relieve you in a couple of hours.
Great.
Ciao. Corporate Prime by Kevin Bayhouse will continue next week on the Sagebrush Variety Show. You're listening to the Sagebrush Variety Show, political commentary and satire, with an irreverent twist.
Are you a factory owner that's plagued with the constant din of rank-and-file work floor proles that are ungrateful for that job you provide for them? Are they missing the expression of your concerns for their well-being after you had to save their wages by canceling their pension program? Do they hold loud union protests outside of your property? Well, you can now up the ante and show them who's boss again with thermobaric grenades. That's right. We at Suppression Defense Systems have developed a small fuel-air explosive that your personal or corporate security forces can employ at a moment's notice. So, when you throw your next executive shindig at the estate, and those restless blue-collar types are hootin' and hollerin' at the front gate, just bring out this little party pleaser and send them running. The 170-decibel shockwave will get your message across, so you can get back to your croquet match with your Wall Street friends. Be the first in your gated community to shock and awe your neighbors and set the tone that matches your capitalist take-charge nature. However, thermobaric grenades may violate your community covenants, so be sure to instruct your legal staff to pencil whip a waiver into the local ordinances. Remember, corporate plundering requires a quiet environment, so don't let the rabble steal your thunder.
Stand. smile. It's a very rare new fact of life. West Nile. It's a source of hysteria. West Nile. You're more likely to die in your sleep. West Nile. They say it's gonna get ya. The county, the city, and the board of noxious weeds. The media, the industry, will tell you you're at risk. They'll tell you poison will save us. They'll say that you could die. They'll spray the state with pesticides and let the good bugs die. There's a scam to sell this crap to Idaho. Now that other states won't spray. There's a scam to sell this crap to Idaho. Now that other states won't spray. So very.
The Sagebrush Variety Show players have grown something in our yards for the past several years. We got started as gardeners for several reasons. Most importantly, a resistance to the predominance of pesticide-laced and genetically modified food that dominate the grocery stores. A desire for self-sufficiency and, to be honest, epicurean pretensions that were rarely satisfied by ingredients that were shrunk-wrapped, refrigerated, and trucked across continents. Some years, our activism took priority over all else, and our gardens suffered. We don't regret that, but in the ensuing years, big agribusiness has grown more and more predatory in their attempts to corner the food market. Pursuing multiple strategies from chemical saturation to trademark piracy, and even entering the organic market just to chip away at the standards as well as the values of that movement. Meanwhile, a post-oil economy is looking like it might come sooner than even we industry critics once anticipated. So this year, our garden is part of our activism. After all, we always said that a major part of the Sagebrush Variety Show agenda is to make inedible lawns, and the pesticides, water waste, and obnoxious mowers that make them possible, an object of derision and scorn. But you know what? Forget about our politics. What we're growing tastes really good. whether you're a fat cat neocon ordered by your doctor to back off the red meat or die, or a limousine liberal fond of the Food Network and public radio shows about rare wines, costly cheeses, and cows grown on remote Japanese islands. We're one up on you. Our harvests are so bodaciously fresh that even the most humble of vegetables makes your caviar pale in comparison. Are you going to sit back and let us have something you don't? And having the leisure time to putter about the garden can be a sign of status to all our comrades in the honest classes. If we can pull this off, so can you.
Tomatoes are a garden favorite, grown even by those who otherwise do not enjoy growing crops. Perhaps this is indicative of the ever-dwindling variety and quality of industrial tomatoes offered in grocery stores. Local small-scale farmers may sell worthy varieties, but unless you're willing to shell out $3 to $4 a pound, you may be tempted to simply grow them yourself. Today's tomatoes are uniform, unblemished, and absolutely flavorless. Just a shadow of what tomatoes can be. They can come in all shapes, sizes, and colors, so it's no surprise so many people choose to grow at least one or two tomato plants every season. Desperate attempts to increase the shelf life of commercial tomatoes hit an all-time low with the development of the genetically modified Flavor Saver tomato in 1994. Its bland flavor and texture rendered it a commercial failure and has since been discontinued. The dull, lifeless varieties now in the stores are a product of traditional plant breeding. Vine-ripened tomatoes are misleading. Unless you consider a tomato ripe when it starts to show the first hint of color on the vine. They may look nice in the stores, but they taste the same as their pastel pink vineless brethren. Tomatoes contain the highly coveted antioxidant lycopene, which is enhanced by cooking, and are excellent sources of vitamin C, vitamin A, iron, calcium, potassium, amino acids, and other antioxidants. Tomatoes were first cultivated by the Aztecs in Central America, although the plant originated in the Andes. Once Europeans discovered the fruit, they spread it throughout the rest of the world rather quickly, and its popularity spread as a novelty. It's a myth that everyone thought tomatoes were poisonous. The Spanish and Italians adopted the tomato into their cuisines pretty much right away, as did much of Asia via the tomato's introduction in the Philippines. It's also a myth that some people thought tomatoes were poisonous because of the pewter dishware used extensively at that time. While it may be true that the acidic qualities of the tomato reacted with the pewter, causing some of its lead content to leach out, lead poisoning is a slow process and would not have been associated with tomatoes by 16th, 17th, and 18th century researchers. However, it probably is true that the tomato was accepted more quickly by peasants who had little choice when faced with food shortages or famine. The tomato became widespread as a welcome addition to regional cuisines, with a few skeptical holdouts such as Germany and Great Britain. For centuries starting in the Middle Ages, the British believed that vegetables were a source of disease, which explains a lot. Tomatoes were finally well established in British cookbooks by the mid-1700s, and in France, the red tomato was a symbol for the French Revolution. However, in the United States, the old British skepticism remained, and most people still believe that a tomato would kill you, until an exasperated tomato lover, Colonel Robert Gibbon Johnson, publicly consumed an entire bushel of tomatoes on the steps of the Boston Courthouse on September 26, 1820, to make his point. When spectators realized that he did not die, they allegedly abandoned their tomato prejudice, and the acceptance of the tomato in the United States was initiated, although the Cajuns in the New Orleans region had been a step ahead for some time. Ironically, the tomato had been reintroduced to North America by the resistant British. Still, it wasn't until well into the 20th century that the tomato became the most popular vegetable. George Washington Carver tried to spur interest in the tomato by publishing How to Grow the Tomato and 115 Ways to Prepare it for the Table in 1936, with little success. He also recommended using the leftover plant at the end of the season to make a vegetable dye. The tomato is indeed a fruit, specifically a berry, although the United States Supreme Court ruled that it was not a fruit but a vegetable in 1893 so that they could tax tomato imports from the Caribbean. In 1980, the USDA went a step further and proposed that ketchup be also classified as a vegetable. After widespread international ridicule, the USDA quietly abandoned its suggestion. California is a top state producer of tomatoes. Florida comes in second, but is the leading source of fresh tomatoes. Most fresh winter tomatoes come from the Immokalee region in Florida, whose workers last year were granted a 1 cent per pound wage increase after a 4-year boycott campaign of Taco Bell and Yum brands. The word ketchup is thought to come from the name of a Malaysian condiment, basically a fish sauce, and the term was used for a long time for any condiment, be it made from anchovies, oysters, mushrooms, walnuts, or even blueberries. The earliest known American tomato ketchup recipe appeared in 1801. Today, much like the ancient and highly respected strict beer-making laws of Germany, very rigid guidelines define what can legally be called ketchup in the U.S. Essentially a thick sauce made with tomatoes, vinegar, sugar, salt, allspice, cloves, and cinnamon. This year, we grew many varieties of tomatoes, including several varieties that popped up as volunteers. The most productive and reliable ones this year were Dr. Carolyn, a pale yellow cherry tomato, Black Prince, a small brown tomato, Orange Banana, an elongated paste tomato, Yellow Bell, a yellow paste tomato, Green Zebra, a small yellow and green striped tomato, Black from Tula, a large dark red tomato, Yellow Pear, a very old pear-shaped variety, and a wild tomato variety also known as currant tomato. We also tried a new variety called Striped Cavern, which is shaped and hollow like a bell pepper and has orange and red stripes, which didn't do too badly. Out of all the non-cherry tomatoes, Orange Banana gets the prize for productivity, although we did have a small problem with blossom end rot earlier in the season. Here are our reactions.
This crop of small breed tomatoes exceeds expectations by leaps and bounds, exotically stimulating. In addition to offering flavor themes unheard of in standard grocery fare, there is stunning variation within breed. A generalization of four of today's picks are as follows. The Dr. Caroline, or simple sweet, with a sour edge, like a lemon head candy, only more wholesome. This standard red cherry is pulpy and wet, an initial citrus burst with a cashew nut finish. The Orange Banana is a complex blend of savory notes, resembling Southeast Asian spice mixes, such as garam masala. And finally, the Cheese Man is an intense flash of citrus, peanut, olive, and floral notes, with virtually no aftertaste. Addictive.
Tomatoes are salty on the tongue, sweet on the lips, prickly on the palate. When a tomato is perfectly ripe, its trinity of flavors blend to exceed the sum of its parts. Or at least they should be. What they try to pass off as a tomato in a store is an abomination. The length of the journey a tomato can withstand is inversely proportional to its worthiness in flavor.
First, I sampled the Orange Banana, a slightly tangy morsel, a bite-sized pleasure. Next, I tried the Yellow Pear, and imbibed its juices. It carries a slightly sweet taste. Then came the Dr. Carolyn, a succulently sweet and tangy selection. As far as I'm concerned, the doctor is in. On to Cheese Man, a sweet-tasting miniature, perfect for snacking, as are all of these picks. And last were the miscellaneous traditionals, which relate a sweet character that all can enjoy.
You're listening to the Sagebrush Variety Show, sagebrushvariety.org, political commentary and satire with an irreverent twist, from Boise, Idaho.
Homeland Security, Level Red. The price of security is eternal surveillance. If you have nothing to hide, then you won't mind if we sneak a little peek.
McGill, I want you to know I appreciate the invitation, and I do think it's sweet of you to ask me to lunch at my favorite restaurant.
I thought you could use a healthy meal after 2 weeks holed up in your apartment, preparing for your law school finals and living on caffeine, chocolate, and stress.
I know, that's very considerate. And I said yes because those are very noble motives.
Thank you.
Don't thank me because, oddly enough, in this case, that's a problem.
What do you mean?
I mean, what are you getting out of this, besides displaying your noble and nurturing nature and what an enlightened male you are?
You're saying I have ulterior motives?
I wish you had ulterior motives.
I'm just trying to get this straight. I tell you why I invited you to lunch. Then you accuse me of having reasons other than those I stated, and say that's a problem, and then you say...
Don't get technical with me. You know what most people mean by ulterior motives.
I do? Isn't the dictionary supposed to provide the definition that most people understand? And my dictionary says that ulterior motives...
See? Now you're in your zone again. Your favorite activities are trying to organize the unorganizable, like me, for instance, and bickering over rules. I want to have fun. That's my primary objective.
Christine, I really don't want to argue. I want to have a pleasant discussion, the aim of which is to find out more about you and why...
Hi, I'm Capri. How may I assist your choosing this afternoon?
Whoa, you came out of nowhere.
Yes, I'm Capri.
What?
Would you like to know more about anything on our menu? Or have you already chosen a path for your lunch experience?
In the I Am Giving dish? What's the kale marinated in?
Oh, I love that salad. The kale is Lacinato from Tao Gardens, an organic permaculture project just outside the city. It's marinated in organic lemons, California-certified extra virgin olive oil, garlic from the restaurant's rooftop garden, and Bay of Biscayne sea salt.
Yummy! Well then, I Am Giving.
Excellent.
And I Am Warm as well?
Yes. And you are thirsty.
I don't see that on the menu. Oh, right, literally. Well, okay, right. I Am Precious.
Mmm. And you?
I'll have the lasagna.
I'm sorry?
The zucchini noodles, layered with cashew ricotta cheese, fresh tomatoes, basil, pesto, and marinara, please.
Are you confused? Would you like me to explain how to use our menu?
No, I think I get it.
I think you'll find it affirming to use the menu name.
No, thanks.
McGill, don't be difficult.
May I recommend an inhibition-loosening beverage?
I'll just share what she's having.
No, you won't.
You are capable.
All right. I Am Fabulous. I Am Luscious. And I Am Playful.
Well done.
I knew you had it in you, McGill. To celebrate, he's rejuvenated on me.
Oh, wonderful. I'll be back in the blink of the Buddha's eye.
Thank you.
Hey, isn't the blink of Buddha's eye like a lifetime or 1,000 years or something?
Relax, McGill. This is a raw foods restaurant. Everything is lovingly trimmed and arranged on your plate for balanced nutrition and aesthetics, but all the marinating is done overnight. I've never waited here for more than 20 minutes. You'll be back at the FBI before your boss notices.
I'm sorry that got heated before Capri came to help us with our choosing, but I still have a question. Now, this is not an argument or a challenge.
Thanks for the warning, but I'll be the judge of that.
Good point.
Don't good point me. It's like you're turned on because I'm doing a good job of giving you a hard time. That's what I'm telling you I want no part of. It's weird. Anyway, what's your question?
If your primary objective is to have fun, then why are you a vegan, considering switching to a raw foods diet?
Whoever said veganism is suffering? You love the food here just as much as I do. You might even call it fun if you didn't have some kind of fear of proclaiming I am sassy in order to get your food. Is vegetarianism less fun for you than a meat-eating diet?
Now that I'm used to it, it's okay, but at first it was difficult for me. I did it because a girlfriend convinced me it's wrong to eat meat because it causes animal suffering, and I don't need it to survive.
That's logical.
Do you have more fun being a vegan than you would if you just ate cheese or meat?
Yes, it's fun to be healthy, and it's not fun to deal with clogged arteries, aching joints, or obesity.
You mean you stopped eating animal products just to stay slim?
And to live long.
But you adopted 3 cats from the animal shelter, and your refrigerator door is covered with cute kitty magnets and photos, and you volunteer for the Humane Society. I just figured...
Okay, McGill, I confess. I changed my diet in the first place because I love animals. Are you happy?
Why do you lie about it?
I don't lie about it. I stopped consuming animal products because of animal cruelty, but it is better for my health, and I'm a little concerned, alright, preoccupied with my weight.
Right, but why are you hiding the real reasons?
Because I hate getting the third degree about it. I'm so sick of the same circular arguments from people who don't want to change their animal eating ways and don't want to face the facts about what's involved in the animal industries.
People just want to know why. Everyone wants to learn. And if you know something they don't, maybe they'll want to use that knowledge.
No, most people feel like if I make what I believe is a moral decision, and they're not making the same decision, then I must be saying that they're immoral and they feel obligated to fight over it. And it's like they're fighting for their very life because they won't just say some stupid cliche like, let's agree to disagree, that you hear when you're winning other arguments. I would prefer not to talk about it at all, but as soon as people see there's no meat on my plate, they demand to know why I won't eat meat. So if I just tell them I'm trying to lose weight, no one feels threatened and I can go on with my life.
If my girlfriend hadn't convinced me, I'd still be eating meat. I've almost gone vegan a couple times because other friends have come close to convincing me that animal products that don't require slaughter are still bad for the environment and create economic injustice. I just still think it's big agribusiness at fault and nothing inherent in the process of making milk chocolate or something.
Yeah, well, they're right, but you do what you want.
Don't you think it would be better for animals and the environment if you told people why you do what you do?
McGill, that's what I've been trying to tell you for like a week. I don't like to argue, I don't like to debate, I don't like answering a million questions. And why are you trying to make me feel guilty? What have you ever done for animal rights?
Well, first of all, I'm always willing to debate about what the most ethical choices are, which is how we all learn. But now that I'm in the FBI investigating corrupt politicians and polluting businesses, it's against regulations for me to take an active role in any other organization.
How convenient.
I still vote green, and I donate to environmental groups and the Green Party, and I made that pledge to your chapter of the Humane Society last month.
Impressive.
When I was in college, I got arrested for protesting one of the last legal cockfight operations in the state.
Really?
Yeah. We were just holding signs and handing out pamphlets in the parking lot. The owners claimed we were blocking the entrance, which wasn't true, but the lot was private property. So we all got taken to jail for a couple hours. But it got us on the news, and a lot of people were surprised to find out there were still cockfights in the state. There's a public outcry, and it got banned.
Let me guess. You got arrested to impress the girl who convinced you to be vegetarian, right? I envy her.
I did it for the cause.
That's cool, too. Does the FBI know about that?
Of course. They do a thorough investigation on all agents.
Weren't they worried about you?
No. They understand that citizens have a right to legally protest, and that even technically illegal stuff like refusing to vacate a private parking lot isn't a real threat to public safety. Of course, they wanted to be sure I wouldn't do anything like that anymore, and I took a lie detector test to say that I would arrest an animal rights protester if they broke the law.
The problem is the laws are getting harsher. That's another reason why I don't stick my neck out. I volunteer at the Humane Society, I post to my blog, and I try not to buy anything that causes suffering.
Here is your bountiful harvest. If you need anything else, please wave me down, and I'll be delighted to help enhance your dining experience.
Thanks, Capri.
McGill?
Yes?
Listen, you're a really nice guy. I'm sure lots of women would appreciate how thoughtful you are. I just don't like the way I act around you. We are just not good together, romantically. I hate how cliched it sounds, but let's just be friends.
Of course we're friends. But why do you have to be so final about
this? McGill, please, this isn't a debate. Stop being so ambiguously persistent. Honestly, it's obvious to me that you don't have a big romantic interest in me. And at this point, I know I don't feel that way about you. It's not like we can prove it through conversation. Now, just pick up your I'm Rejuvenated and let's have a toast. Cheers.
McGill here.
Dude, did you hear the 411?
I don't think so. I haven't really kept up with the news or even the inter-office memos. You know, I've been pretty busy juggling a few public corruption cases, and there's some personal stuff. Remember Christine?
Yo, respect. But I don't want to talk about your love life. I just don't have the strength right now.
Oh.
This weekend we can talk about it, I swear. Just not right now when I'm feeling up. Your stories bring me low, brother.
Okay, I understand.
I'm telling you, forget about the women's. I got some fat news you can get jiggy with.
Lay it on me, G.
Now you keeping it real. Check it. Congress just passed the Animal Enterprises Terrorism Act.
Oh, that.
Oh, that? Why are you not 100% stoked?
Honestly, I don't get it. The Animal Enterprises Protection Act already dealt with criminal acts against businesses targeted by animal rights groups. Do we really need to expand our definition of terrorism in order to fight crime?
It can't hurt. Everybody wants to stop terrorists. So if that's what we call the bad guys these days, I'm down with that. But what rocks my world is, I can go after people who hurt business, whether it's by pretending to be employees and then tattling on their bosses, or with their protests or even their crazy propaganda. Just because those animal freaks don't actually blow stuff up doesn't mean I shouldn't get to put the kibosh on their nefarious agenda.
I don't think that's the intention of the law, Bailey.
Word! It's right there in black and white. Everyone in the department says so.
Congress wouldn't pass something like what you describe. The First Amendment and the rest of the Bill of Rights is still the cornerstone of our democracy.
What color is the sky in your world? Even the leftists know the jig is up with this law. The Humane Society tried to mobilize their people to shut it down, but Congress held on to their principles.
The Humane Society is a leftist organization?
Yeah.
It's grandmas saving kitty cats.
That's just a front.
Whatever. I'm just saying, if I were working terrorism, I wouldn't go busting people for taking pictures of factory farms or handing out leaflets in front of fast food chains. Ethics aside, it's just going to get thrown out in court anyway. And then you'll be wasting taxpayers' money.
Activist judges be damned. It's a brave new world for crime fighters.
Okay, I'm not going to argue with you. I got a full caseload and women problems. If you want to put all that work into cases just to have them thrown out in court, that's your problem. Terrorism is not my department.
McGill, it's all your department.
Yeah, I'm a bureau man now and I can get called in.
No, I mean as a citizen. Everything the government does is every citizen's department.
Now you're the one who sounds like Nader.
Watch your mouth. You're my homie now. Even if you are misguided sometimes, but I will smack you down if you deserve it.
Do you want me to form an honest opinion about this new law or not?
I want you to get on board with the preemptive law enforcement agenda. No more fence sitting.
I'm not fence sitting. I'm telling you, either your interpretation of the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act is wrong, or the law is simply unconstitutional.
All right. Here's how we settle it. Tonight at Quincy's, I'm going to go kung fu on your hiney at the foosball table. Might makes right.
Bailey, I could definitely go for some foosball action tonight. But let's not pretend bar games can settle political debates.
See you at 5:15.
McGill here.
Nick, I really can't believe you would, for all my complaints about you, but did you get your friends from the Joint Terrorism Task Force to arrest me for being a cat rescuer?
What?
Let me tell you what happened the other day, after we had lunch at Earthly Delights.
Christine, did I make a mistake moving in with you based on nothing more than a catcrazyroommates.com ad?
What are you talking about?
There's a line of police cars outside the house. Here they come. Just tell me what you did so I know what to expect. I won't hold it against you.
Don't be silly. It's some kind of mistake. Relax. Sit down. Finish your breakfast. I'll get the door. Just a second. Hello, officers. What can
Freeze, mother. Ma'am.
I'm not ma'am.
We have a warrant for your arrest.
For me? Christine Cedric?
That's right. It looks clear. Proceed with caution to the interior of the premises.
Hold on. This is a body warrant, not a search warrant. I'll go with you, but I don't want you in my house.
What are you reading? National Lawyers Guild pamphlets? Don't believe that propaganda.
I'm in law school.
Great. Officer Pranafi, put her in the back of the squad car.
What's the charge?
We're taking in everyone who posted threats to the Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty website.
Threats?
Don't play innocent. Officer Pranafi, the squad car. And don't let her slow you down with her big mouth.
Big mouth? Hold on a second. Don't harass my roommate, and be careful with my cat Squeegee Bo.
Yeah. Okay, guys. I want you to do a thorough search, including opening up any suspicious-looking mail.
What is going on here?
Let's see your ID.
Hold on. You're arresting my roommate, right? What do I have to do with this?
If you're not wrapped up in the same nonsense as her, you should have thought more carefully before you signed a lease with her.
I found her on catcrazyroommates.com.
Birds of a feather.
What?
You should be careful what kind of company you keep. These are dangerous times.
Hold on. You get your hands off my mail. Give it here. Let go.
That's it. Officer Grebe, escort her outside until we finish the search.
I'm in my underwear, you goon. I'm not going anywhere until I get dressed.
We can't let you do that. You could be hiding evidence for your girlfriend.
My roommate. And you have no right.
Another word from you and you will be arrested for obstruction of justice.
You can't do this. I know my rights. Hold on. Wait, just a second. If Princess doesn't get her medication at precisely 9:15, she gets the most terrible diarrhea.
What they called a threat was just a call for a boycott, and I didn't even make it. I clicked reply, so the call for the boycott was part of my message. All I said was that Huntington had a lot of nerve calling what they did science when it was redundant, pointless, and the lab assistants were causing pain that had nothing to do with the study.
Christine, you have to believe I had nothing to do with that.
You know the crazy thing? I go to all this trouble to avoid confrontation and do the bare minimum my conscience will allow, and I end up sitting in a concrete cell, starving and listening to smooth jazz. So with my time, I'm trying to figure out how to make sense of it. So first I think you must have turned me in because of something I said at lunch.
Christine.
Then I figured you couldn't have informed on me, because what I said made me sound like such a wimp, and I know what a stickler you are for literal interpretations.
Christine.
So I was going to make you my one phone call, since I figured you'd get me out faster than some lawyer out of the yellow pages, but then I thought maybe he did turn me in out of revenge for breaking off our romance.
Christine.
I know that's a total fantasy, and I was so humiliated even having it, that I went ahead and called the lawyer out of the yellow pages.
Christine.
Shut up! Let me talk. So hearing your voice, I believe you didn't have anything to do with my arrest. I just wanted to make sure. But I can't see you anymore. Not as friends, not as anything. It's too messed up.
Christine.
Goodbye, Nick.
This was a dramatization. A comic dramatization. But in the world of audio theater, it is said that truth is stranger than fiction, especially when it comes to the Department of Homeland Security. Imagine if you will. No, don't imagine. See our links posted at sagebrushvariety.blogspot.com. A United States intelligence and law enforcement community whose concept of preemptive law enforcement profiles vegetarians and people who adopt stray animals as high risk and launches a public relations initiative to alert the public that animal rights and environmental groups are a threat to public safety. A United States Congress so thoroughly infected with corporate fascism that the only form of liberty defended is the ability of corporations to make profit unhindered by regulation. A Congress willing to give unanimous approval to a law that defines a huge number or their living human constituents, anyone with a shred of compassion that extends beyond the human race, as terrorists, and which criminalizes non-destructive free speech if it could hurt the ability of a business to profit from animals. an FBI so eager to make use of their broadened powers to protect business that it arrested the Shack 7, six people, and a non-profit corporation protesting the activities of the Huntington Animal Lab. The group is indicted for such heinous acts as posting a videotape of tortured dogs inside the lab, a letter-writing campaign to the company and businesses with connections to it, for maintaining a message board, and for being such a First Amendment nuisance that they caused the Animal Experiments Lab to lose profit. The Shack 7 were arrested under the Animal Enterprises Protection Act, while an even broader Animal Enterprises Terrorism Act is making its way through Congress. The group has been sentenced up to 13 years in prison for speaking out. No judge has been willing to defend the Constitution and appeal the sentence yet. Meanwhile, industry and law enforcement groups openly celebrate the victory and promise a future of even stiffer sentences for an even larger set of activities. Seem too silly to be true? Believe it.
Homeland Security, Level Red, was written by Robert McMinn and was performed and produced by the Sagebrush Variety Show with the help of a grant from the Green Institute and support from Radio Boise. Learn more about the topics in this show at sagebrushvariety.org. This week's Sagebrush Variety Show was conceived, written, performed, and produced by Robert McMinn, Kevin Bayhouse, April Hoy, and Gwen Sankirico, and was funded in part by a grant from the Green Institute. For more information on the content discussed on this program, visit our website at sagebrushvariety.org. Write to us at sagebrush@radioboise.org. Thanks for listening to the Sagebrush Variety Show.